This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Well, we have an individual mandate on healthcare here in the Bay State, but does it really make you feel like the government is forcing you to eat broccoli?
That's correct, Scalia, but you never know whether you're going to
be
that person.
Could you define the market? Everybody has to buy food sooner or later, so you define the market as food. Therefore, everybody's in the market. Therefore, you can make people buy broccoli.
A Massachusetts take on the Supreme Court healthcare arguments.
Also, Boston and the teachers' union reach an impasse over contract talks.
If, in fact, they're very serious, they would have come to a different set of recommendations at the table through these 21 months.
And the MBTA recommends raising fares, much to the distress of many customers.
How much is the train going to be after the fares are increases? What trains are going to be taken away from me? What am I going to do without the train? What is all of you going to do without the train?
Well, joining us now to review all the week's news is Scott Lehigh, columnist for the Boston Globe. Welcome back, Scott.
Thank you.
Also with us is Garrett Quinn. He writes the Less is More blog at Boston.com and is a contributor to Reason magazine. Welcome back to you, Garrett.
Thanks for having me.
All right, well, let's start with the Supreme Court hearings this week on the Affordable Care Act. Many analogies we heard used to describe it, broccoli, the burial insurance market. But I was particularly curious about what happened on day three when the court heard arguments over what would happen to healthcare reform overall if the Supremes strike down that individual mandate. So we have a little bit of tape here. It's of Justice Sonia Sotomayor, who was pressing Paul Clement, the man who was arguing against so-called Obamacare, on why it wouldn't be better to preserve the rest of the law and let Congress figure out how to just deal with that invalidated individual mandate part, if that is how the Supremes decide.
Bottom line is, why don't we let Congress fix it?
Well, let me answer the bottom line question, which is, no matter what you do in this case, at some point there's going to be, if you strike down the mandate, there's going to be something for Congress to do. The question is really, what task do you want to give Congress? Do you want to give Congress the task of fixing the statute after something has been taken out, especially a provision at the heart, or do you want to give Congress the task of fixing health care? And I think it would be better in this situation.
We're not taking, if we strike down one provision, we're not taking that power away from Congress. Congress could look at it without the mandatory coverage provision and say, this model doesn't work, let's start from the beginning.
All right. Well, Scott, it sounds like at least Justice Sotomayor is wondering how the court could decide that wouldn't undermine so-called Obamacare entirely.
Well, there certainly would be ways to fix it if you didn't wipe the whole law out. But given the political situation, the power dynamic in Washington right now, if it is all wiped out, it won't be passed again. I mean, one big tension, obviously, is you cannot have an exclusion, a denial of you can't forbid people to not issue insurance because of pre-existing conditions. In other words, say everyone gets insurance, and also say you don't have to have insurance individually, because otherwise people only get insurance when they're ill. So they would have to fix that. But there are ways to do it, I think.
Well, your column in the Globe recently just took a sort of bigger look at this, on the impact that this case is having or will have on the Supreme Court itself. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think it would really hurt the court. I got to say, I was just underwhelmed by the activist conservative judges and the way they went after the law, particularly Scalia, who displayed such a crashing lack of intellectual precision when, in analogies that were, I mean, frankly, just to call it on varnish, they were stupid. They were not analogies that made any sense in the context of this law. Analogizing it to making people buy broccoli or to possibly forcing you to buy a car, and also showed he doesn't understand insurance, and frankly, he didn't seem to understand economics either. So I thought it was not a good performance for the court. Alito a little better. I thought Kennedy looked good. I mean, the center-left people in the court kind of wanted to try the government's case for it, I think so.
Garrett, your thoughts?
Well, I definitely agree with Scott that if they just got the mandate, there really is no. I think most of the law will fall. And one of the big arguments that you're already starting to hear is that if you've got the mandate, it's going to cause a surge in health insurance premiums because of the clause that covers pre-existing conditions. In the makeup of Congress as it stands, if they repeal the law completely, I don't see anything coming in its place, because you've seen the way the White House, the Washington's acted for the last, you know, several years. There's just no desire at this juncture to get anything done.
Mm. Well, I was wondering if we could take a step back and sort of see how people, or at least political figures here in Massachusetts, might be looking at what's been going on in the Supreme Court. I mean, there's obviously talk about how this is going to factor into the presidential election, but what about that Massachusetts Senate election? I mean, when Senator Scott Brown was elected, he was in part elected as, quote, the 41st vote against the Affordable Care Act.
That was one of the big selling points on him. I remember at one point during that campaign, they were even pushing a hashtag on Twitter that was vote 41 or 41st senator or something like that. I'm not really sure how much I think it will play into the Senate race down the road. I think so much of the – in Massachusetts, it's different since we've had the mandate for quite a long while. Most voters, I think, are – and polls have indicated this – are okay with the law in Massachusetts, which is – and they've also said that they think that law was really what gave birth to Obamacare. I think at the end, too, this election is really going to come down to jobs and the economy. Plus, Elizabeth Warren is really pushing the consumer advocacy side of her background. She's pushing her efforts to Wall Street reform, consumer protection. Mm-hmm. I don't see it playing that big of a role.
Scott,
but June,
let me get Scott back in here.
I think it depends very much on how the presidential candidates react to it. If the law were struck down and Obama were to say, okay, look, the only way we can fix this, if you want health care, is for you to send me a substantial majority here in the Senate and the House, and that became a polarizing kind of rallying cry, that then I suppose there's an effect. I'm not sure he'll do that. I tend to think he'll take more of a hands off. But I think it those are chess pieces that remain to be played. So I think it's a little hard to say at this point. Scott Brown, obviously, he voted for the mass bill. He was against the national bill, mm-hmm. but he didn't really, you know. So it's a little hard to know.
Well, let's move on, if we can, to contract talks and the impasse between the Boston Teachers Union and the school department. They've been in talks for almost 2 years, 21 months to be exact. But this week, both sides said they'll ask the state to appoint a mediator to resolve the stalemate. So here's the head of the teachers union, Richard Stutman.
Mediators are trained to draw out both parties, and we hope that they can get her to come to the table.
Okay, the her he's referring to, of course, is Superintendent Carol Johnson, whom Stutman claims hasn't been as present as she should have been in the negotiations so far. So here's how Johnson responded.
I meet with the president of the teachers union every single month for a couple of hours, and we go through many, many issues. I think it's disingenuous to imply that the outcome would be different because it doesn't explain why the union has not been willing to reconsider their financial package.
Okay, so political sniping aside, there are practical things at stake here regarding teachers' contracts and, of course, education in the city of Boston. Garrett, let's just start with you. Your thoughts on this?
Well, the raise they're looking for is really tied, I think, in a lot of ways towards that extra half hour that they're talking about. There's no question that you should not get paid for working extra. And the raise they're asking for, I'll be honest, it doesn't strike me as that much. But when you put it in retrospect of what everybody else is going through this economy, it's really hard to sympathize with them when a lot of us haven't got raises for quite a long time. But as far as Menino's point on assigning teachers, and that was really in that big policy speech they gave, I don't know enough about the ins and outs of how they assign that stuff, but it seems like if they don't come to something, they're going to have they'll resolve something. I think eventually they have to, right?
Mm. Well, just to be clear, the financial compensation that's at issue here would be a 10.3% salary increase
over three years. Yeah.
Exactly, Scott. Your thoughts on this?
Well, I think it's a disaster for the BTU. Frankly, I think that this is a union that's been stuck in the past and myopic for a long time. I think there's a real test here whether the Boston system can change the way it needs to inside the constraints of a negotiated contract. And if you follow closely the history of the BTU, I think that's very much in doubt. And in this case, I mean, these guys are asking for a 10%+ raise over 3 years, which really is very different from, as Garrett says, from what people get in the private sector, plus money, extra pay for the additional half hour they'll work. Now, so they're looking for kind of a double-barreled raise there, which strikes me as extraordinary. And frankly, I think an educational consumer has to look at it this way and say, look, I can get a much longer school day for the same per pupil dollar expenditure and better results from a charter school, or I can pay through my nose to get another half hour out of the Boston Teachers Union. I got to say, as a taxpayer and as someone, as an educational consumer, I think most people would say, I'd rather go with a charter school. So I think if we don't see a meaningful deal here, and by that I mean something that within the confines of what we're looking at here, a great big raise in a small addition of time, I think you are going to see another concerted campaign to lift the charter cap.
We got to remember, too, that the raise they're looking for isn't just the teachers. This is spread out across teachers' aides, substitutes. So I think it's a lot. I think they're not going to win in the court of public opinion when you look at the amount of money they're really asking for. Yeah, $32 million doesn't sound like a lot when you spread it over 3 years, but when everybody else looks at their checks, they look at what they're paying in property taxes, they're going to grumble and they're just, come on.
Mm. But it's the city that's at 33. I think the teachers, the 4 year cost of that, as I understand it, is about $120 million, and then you got to add another, you know, depending on how you slice the numbers, somewhere between another $20 to $30 million a year for the extra time. So it's a pretty good chunk of change.
Well, if we could move on to one last story that also has to do with a pretty good chunk of change. That is, of course, the MBTA. And the Transit Authority announced its proposal for a 23% fare hike this week. That plus some service cuts are going to largely help close the T's $161 million budget deficit for this year. Now, this is one situation in which everyone agrees that nobody's very happy, since it doesn't actually do anything to solve the T's long-term problems. So this is a point that Transportation Secretary Richard Davey made on our program back in February.
Even if we're able to come up with something or solve even a portion of this year, it only pushes the problem off to next year and next year. So while the deficit this year is $161 million, 3 years from now, the T's deficit is $330 million.
So it doubles almost.
It doubles.
Okay, Garrett, what do you think?
Well, you know, the governor earlier this week talked about there's a need for revenues. When any politician ever says revenues, that really means taxes. I don't think you're going to see that in any form. I know that a lot of the protesters we've talked about, I know Mike Widmer's talked about this, you know, raising the gas tax to come to the rescue of the T. The legislature's been very firm that they're not going to raise tax. The leaders of the legislature, both the Senate and the House, have both said they're not going to raise taxes. I don't see that happening. To say, come to the T's rescue.
Scott?
I think what's going on here is the legislature is unwilling to do anything on the tax revenue or revenue side in a big way in an election year. So these guys are kicking the can down the road to next year and temporizing with this agreement. I think there's almost a concerted effort to have increases in effects that will gin up public outrage and get people ready for, you know, make people think about what kind of system they want and perhaps make them more receptive to it, to doing something after the election year. I think one thing they could do is take a lot of the debt off the shoulders of the team. If they didn't have to service that debt, it would free up more money for operating costs. And that's a way they could do it without looking as though they were just directly, you know, raising taxes for them. But they would have to find a way to fit that extra debt in under the bond cap. But I think we'll see something next year on that, because I think the system is kind of falling apart otherwise.
Well, I'm afraid that's all the time we have to discuss the week's news today, because I do want to leave a little bit of time for our weekly hubbubs. And those are the stories that didn't quite make it to the top of the fold. Anthony, yours?
Yeah, well, mine has to be about baseball because, as you all know, even though snow is in the forecast for some parts of the state, the baseball season begins next week. And I want to take a particular note of the once great Manny Ramirez. Since he left Boston, he's played for Los Angeles, Cleveland, Tampa Bay, Chicago, now Oakland. He's trying to make the cut there. Suspended for testing positive for drugs. Still has to serve a 50-game suspension. 40 years old. He's put on weight. And, oh, yeah, he was charged with domestic battery for allegedly slapping his wife and knocking her down. Well, hope springs eternal. This week, those charges were dropped. Manny hit his first spring training home run. But still, he's one problem the Red Sox aren't going to miss when they take the field next week.
No, they're not. Scott, your hubbub?
The Patrick administration quietly moving to put a project labor agreement on reconstruction of the Longfellow Bridge, which means that only union firms could work on the project. Second one they've done, one in UMass, on about $750 million of construction here. This is about a quarter of $1 billion worth of construction, expensive and bad policy.
Wow. Okay. Garrett Quinn, you're...
There's a video circulating around the internet right now, and I'm still trying to figure out exactly where all the footage came from, but somebody's cobbled up this old 16mm film of somebody driving around Boston in 1964, and it's all in color, and it goes from Central Square, Kenmore Square, Inman Square. It goes all over between Boston, Cambridge, and Brookline, and it is fascinating to watch because it's very good quality film. And if you just go to YouTube or Google driving Boston 1964, you're going to find this remarkable step back in time.
I'll have to check that out. My hubbub is a short and simple one. It's also a bit of an admission. Yes, I did buy a lottery ticket today.
You're going to share with us, right? This is the WBUR office pool right here. I want that on the record.
Garrett Quinn is the author of the Less is More blog at Boston.com and a contributor to Reason Magazine. Garrett, always great to have you.
Thank you.
And Scott Lehigh is a columnist for the Boston Globe. Scott, always great to have you, too.
Thanks for having me.
Well, coming up, maple syrup, Somerville bread. Believe it, it's true. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.